You are listening to the Gable Media Continuing Education podcast feed, the most entertaining and convenient way for AEC professionals to get continuing education credits, including AIA-approved courses. As a Gable member, just listen and follow the link in the show notes to take a brief quiz and obtain your credit today. Enjoy. Welcome to Building a Resilient Future, Architecture, Climate Action, and Environmental Justice, the first of our Gable Media All Access series. For those that don't know me, my name is Demetrius Lynch. I am the co-founder and chief creative officer at Gable Media. I am also a California-based architect, NCARP certified, and LEED and WELL accredited professional. Through my architecture practice lines, I've been dedicated to improving the built environment through my expertise in residential design, sustainability, and human wellness. Now, as people are coming into this session, I invite you to blow up the chat, say hi, let us know where you're checking in from. And while you do that, I want to quickly tell you what this series is and why you should keep an eye out for future events. The Gable Media All Access Series is an exclusive event where we bring together leading professionals from the AEC community in an intimate setting designed for meaningful connections and impactful discussions. This session offers Gable Media members the unique opportunity to engage directly with industry leaders, exploring vital topics, discussing the latest trends, and identifying innovative solutions that are shaping the future of the AEC landscape. But we are opened up to the greater public this time around. But in the future, with limited participants, you'll have unparalleled access to ask your most pressing questions and gain groundbreaking insights that can propel your career and projects forward. Again, today's session is Building a Resilient Future, Architecture, Climate Action, and Environmental Justice. This will be one of the most wide-ranging and all-encompassing discussions about building a resilient environment that I've ever been a part of. We will be discussing sustainability, architecture, and urban revitalization to explore actionable strategies for addressing climate change, environmental justice, and creating resilient, inclusive communities. But before we begin, we have a few housekeeping items to get through. If you're not currently a member of Gable Media, there's still a chance to receive AIA CE credit for this session by becoming a member today. As an added bonus for our current members, you should have received an email with a link to attend this private feed for this session. Immediately after this panel discussion, we will have a private Q&A. All are welcome to share questions throughout the discussion and whatever chats you have. And we'll try to squeeze in a couple, but the current members can participate in a private Q&A after, and even we'll be able to call in to speak directly with the panel. So if you're a member and watching via YouTube, make sure you check your email for how to join us in the private feed. And if you're not currently a Gable Media member, membership will get you credit for today's session, hold your spot for all future All Access Series events, access to our innovative podcast-based CE program, which we have 30 courses available right now, and even more on the way, and the inside scoop to other Gable Media events and perks. Now, Gable Media is an official AIA continuing education credit provider. There are particular standards we have to meet, so feel free to contact us and AIA if there are any concerns about the program. This session is not endorsed by AIA of any materials or methods of dealing with products that are discussed. The intent of the session has been reviewed and approved by AIA, so all Gable Media members will receive one HSW credit for attending this session. Gable Media members only. Now, in today's session, you'll hear from our insightful panel, Stephen Bierstaker, Farah Kadir, Eric Corey Freed, and Majora Carter. But to set the stage, I want to quickly mention how this particular All Access series even came about. So for those that may not know, I have a podcast called Spaces, and this fall I released a 10-episode limited series called Going Green. In it, I uncover the little-known stories about our environment that everyone needs to hear. The series shares insights into the forces shaping our world and explores the complex intersections of people, place, our environment, policy, and corporate influence. If you haven't already, I hope you'll check out Going Green. It's available wherever you stream your podcasts or at lions.studio/podcasts-going-green. Now, with that foundation, I wanted to pull together a remarkable panel to expand on the conversation and share actionable insights that can drive meaningful change. For the panel today, we have Stephen Biersteker.
Hey, everyone.
Stephen Biersteker is an architect, AIBC, an associate at ThinkSpace Architecture, Planning, and Interiors. With nearly a decade of experience, Stephen has been a passionate advocate of sustainability and innovation in architecture. At ThinkSpace, he is actively developing a firm-wide project performance brief to track sustainability metrics on every project. He also shares insights through his newsletter, The Carbon Architect, and LinkedIn to elevate the profession, simplify carbon-conscious design, and inspire architects to create better, more sustainable buildings. Thanks for joining us, Stephen. Next, we have Farah Kadir. She's a registered architect, LEED AP, LFA, and a senior sustainable design project manager at New York City School Construction Authority, or SCA. Farah is a licensed architect based in New York City, specializing in energy efficiency, green building standards, and sustainable design. She shares expertise as a green building journalist, social media advocate, and committee member for national sustainability initiatives, currently focusing on green school projects with the NYC School Construction Authority.
Thank you for having me.
And next we have Eric Corey Freed, registered architect, LEED fellow, Eco Districts AP, LFA, Active Score AP, and principal and director of sustainability at Canon Design. Eric is an award-winning architect, author, and speaker, leading teams to create regenerative, low-carbon buildings, a LEED fellow, an advocate for biophilic design. He has authored 12 books and is recognized as a trailblazer in green architecture and net zero innovation. Thanks for joining us, Eric.
Oh, my honor to be here.
We don't have Majora. She wasn't able to make it, at least for now. So we'll jump ahead and let's get into this conversation. Eric, you were a guest on my podcast, I think maybe 2 years ago. And in our conversation, you did a great job of simplifying the mechanics of climate change as a foundation for today's discussion and to set up what we're going to talk about. Can you explain the key causes and effects driving extreme weather events that we're experiencing today?
I want everybody to get up and look in the mirror. And no, that's a joke. What's driving it? The gigatons of carbon and hydrocarbons that we release into the atmosphere that shouldn't be there, that are getting trapped and trapping the heat. There was extreme weather before climate change. And I know often people will use that as a kind of a talking point of, we had hurricanes before climate change. Yes, of course we did. But we've never had them at this magnitude, at this scale, at this frequency. It's somewhat unprecedented. And fortunately, we have data, piles and piles of data showing us this. If you think about it, the last 8 years were the hottest years on record globally. These extreme weather impacts will continue to increase. And virtually nowhere is immune to this, right? 2024 is not completely done yet, but we already know it'll be either the top or number two hottest year on record. And this is just something we're going to have to get used to now. Since 1980, I think that there were over 400 climate disasters in the U.S. that caused at least $1 billion in damages each. Half of them were in Texas. you know, and the bulk of them were in the southeast portion of the country. And yet these are states that in some cases are trying to even deny that climate change exists or making it illegal to even talk about it, like avoiding it would magically make it go away. So the issue is us, right? Our kind of fear of this existential threat of climate change that we've known about for a long time. And the warnings have come for decades and we kind of failed to believe them or to act or something like that. So that's, this is a pretty depressing question, by the way, that you're starting us off with. But yeah, that's where we are.
Yeah.
Your partial access code is 7. Your partial access code is 7.
And then I think you also had talked about, I think you referred to it as sort of an engine of how the globe works and how the heat rises and it adds to the certain motion of all of the hurricanes and all of that. Can you expand on that a little bit that you had previously talked about?
Yeah. So I, you know, the climate moves in a kind of a conveyor belt across the planet. I'm oversimplifying it, but it moves in this conveyor belt that we call the jet stream. It's why the beaches in Miami, the water is warm. And yet when you get up to New York, the water is freezing. It's because the jet stream starts there and moves upward. And it's like a conveyor belt around the planet, and it drives a lot of our weather systems. It's why the weather systems ordinarily would be very predictable. It's why hurricanes typically start in the southeast portion of the Atlantic and move upward, right? It's all part of that conveyor belt. The trouble is that we have a lot of melting ice at the top and bottom of the globe. It's dumping fresh water into the ocean, so it's desalinating that water. The water is also cold. As the planet heats up, that fresh water moves differently than salt water does. And so it's causing the conveyor belt to essentially stop. If it stops fully, nobody knows what will happen, right? The planet's trying to kind of always be in balance, always be in equilibrium. And our actions of trapping these gases in the atmosphere are knocking that out of whack. Again, pretty depressing question.
Yes.
But I speak all over North America, and oftentimes I get hecklers in the audience. And by the way, it's always white men. I don't know why, but it's always who they stand up, they start yelling at me, and they don't believe climate change. I used to love when it happens because I would just destroy them from the stage. Because after all, I have a microphone, and they don't. But you know, I've heard all of these objections before. I'm sure all the panelists have. And there's an abundance of science to refute any of that. But I had an epiphany a few years ago, which is I'm not here to debate climate change with them. No sooner would I debate climate change than I would debate gravity, right? So why am I even wasting my time? You know, I'm almost fueling their ignorance by even giving it credibility. And I think we've kind of lost a little bit of that recently with what's been going on.
Thank you, Eric. I wanted to take a quick break to introduce Majora Carter, real estate developer, urban revitalization strategy consultant, MacArthur Fellow, and Peabody Award-winning broadcaster. Majora transforms underserved communities through sustainable development, job creation, and local wealth building. A TED Talk speaker and award-winning broadcaster, she collaborates with organizations like Google, MIT, and Etsy to foster innovation. Her projects, such as the Boogie Down Grind and Startup Box, combat what she refers to as brain drain and drive economic growth in the South Bronx and beyond. She has a new book that you have to check out. It's called Reclaiming Your Community, and you can grab that through her website. Majora, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Stephen, you're a good person to follow up that question to Eric. You've provided valuable insights into how buildings contribute to those carbon emissions and climate change. What are 2 to 3 key factors or contributors that the AEC industry should be most aware of when addressing carbon in architecture?
Yeah, and I just kind of wanted to follow up on one of the things Eric said, which is we don't know what's going to happen if the jet stream or the Atlantic current stops. There's this great movie from, I don't know, early 2000s, The Day After Tomorrow, which kind of tries to show what that might look like. So if you want to blast from the past, check that out. But I think when you talk about kind of the bigger picture type stuff, we know that buildings are a massive contributor to climate change. I think the figure's around 40% of an impact. both from new building construction, from existing building operation. So we know that it's a big contributor. But the good thing about that is it's obviously a big opportunity for a solution-based approach. And that's one of the things I really encourage people to do is take a positive approach. There's so much negative talk in this area because it's a scary thing that I think we need to continue to elevate the industry in a positive way and think about solutions. But if you've been in kind of the AEC sustainability world for any amount of time or even heard people talking, there's this idea of embodied carbon, which is the carbon that is greenhouse gas emissions from building materials. And then there's the operational side, which is the emissions from your gas heating system, your electricity. So those are kind of the two streams. And traditionally, like codes have really focused on energy use the most. Now, obviously, there's a lot of codes that are still so far behind, and we're building buildings that aren't really high performance. But what I usually recommend for people to do is to make sure that they're looking at both sides of that equation and not just doing one. And I also really encourage architects and other building professionals to understand their local context that they're designing in. I design in Vancouver, Canada. And most of the buildings that I work on, 98% of the emissions come from the materials because all of our electricity is from hydroelectricity. And we do a lot of our buildings as all electric now. So when it comes to reducing emissions on our buildings, getting your energy use lower doesn't have very much of an impact. And that's just regional. And that's one of the challenges I have when I talk about things on social media is I'll blanket statement things. And then someone's like, hey, you know, where I live, it's XYZ because we run on coal. And it's like, well, yeah, you have a totally different scenario than I do. So I think the regional lens is really important when we talk about sustainable design and carbon reduction.
Farah, Stephen kind of set you up as far as kind of the code and policy standpoint. With so many sustainability certifications and standards that are out there, how do you determine which ones are the most impactful for a project? And how can architects and other AEC professionals kind of balance the goals of certification with practical constraints in terms of budget, material, and design intent?
Yeah, it's a good question because there are so many certification programs that are cropping up now, and it's confusing as to which one a project should go for. And really, it's a very individualized process. Just because one is more popular or mainstream doesn't mean that it will fit with your particular project. You have to look at your owner's needs, your design goals, your own intent, and then align it with the certification program. So different programs have different performance targets, which help determine your project's green goals. So one program might emphasize achieving a zero waste building. One program might emphasize achieving a net zero energy building. So what is it that you are aligning with? Second, you have to look at the size of your project. If you have a larger, more complex project, you may want to go for a certification program that is more comprehensive and covers different target areas because you may be able to meet many different parameters. But smaller projects can go for more simpler certifications that have maybe one particular green goal. There are several parameters, though, that can really help you hone in on which certification program to go for. One being your local jurisdiction. New York City, for example, does require for its public projects to maintain a LEED at a particular tier. So certain cities may also offer certain incentives economically. So that's definitely first avenue to look at. But there are several other factors that I personally recommend when looking at these programs. Third-party verification is definitely very important. That would help lend credibility to inherently green design. Look for something that will require that additional layer of credibility. And then also, I highly recommend finding a certification program that monitors and enforces post-occupancy performance targets. You know, we want measured results. We don't want design results, per se, to drive up, you know, what the green goal is of the project so that there are no surprises down the road. You know, you take a look at the building's performance and you see the energy consumption may not have aligned with the energy model, which is often what happens. So again, we want to measure the occupancy usage and real-time monitoring. And then also you want to take a look at, in the certification program, what focus of sustainability is emphasized. So certain certification programs now tend to emphasize health and wellness versus another. So some programs focus, as I said, on energy or water, and others are more broad. And then one additional factor I'd mention is some certification programs. If your property value is very important to you, which ones are widely recognized or in your own country or in your jurisdiction, and then go off of that. And online, you can find a database of which projects have been certified locally in your area. So that's a great resource or great way to figure out what might make sense for your climate.
The disproportionate impact of, it was funny, Eric joined our call, our pre-call earlier, and talked about the dread that that he was feeling of this collapse of our climate. But this impact is highly felt, disproportionately felt in low-income and marginalized communities, which is a conversation that's often overlooked. Urban revitalization efforts face the challenge of uplifting these communities while also preventing the double-edged sword of displacement. Based on your experience as an urban revitalization strategist and environmental justice advocate, how can architects and other AEC professionals ensure that sustainability and that revitalization promotes equity and avoids gentrification?
That's a big question and a really good one. Yeah. And the answer is, there are many answers. And that's the beautiful part, because there's so many folks that can play a role. And yes, definitely AEC fields are one of them. To give you like a little story of this is basically what not to do. So I sort of cut my teeth in the environmental justice solutions world. And so, which meant, since we were playing in a space where design really wasn't given, you know, that much credence, you know, in a place like the South Bronx in an inner city, but we wanted to do this really amazing project. We transformed this dump into a park, you know, was it the beta version? Then we were able to elicit so much excitement around it that we were actually in line to get a $3 million investment in that park to create like one of the first waterfront parks our communities had in over, gosh, at that point, almost 70 years. Like, we just did not have those kind of spaces that literally were designed, you know, to love up on our community, to make it the kind of place that people wanted to be in. And it was right after 9/11 when obviously city budgets were just like kind of flipped out. Everybody was like going a little crazy, and rightfully so. But one of the things that happened was that the city decided to put like a total kibosh on new projects like parks. It wasn't considered like a real thing. And I was just like, wait a second, if anything, like what we need are more of these like third spaces, gathering spaces. And so, but at that point, you know, I was like sort of a known quantity, and I got invited to this big thing called TED. And there happened to be around the same exact time, one of the bigger projects in New York City, also a park development project, of which I will not say what it is because that would give away too much. But the designers of that project were just like, the red carpet was rolled out, literally rolled out by the city and private sector, just like, we love up on this place and it's going to happen. And so I ran into one of the designers, and I was like, you know what? I could use your help, because here we are, a community that is in desperate need of the things that positive design can actually provide for our communities. And I need you, Starkitect, to basically talk to my city about that. Just using your position and just say, you know what? We can't just only be building good things, you know, in higher status communities. We actually need to be doing these things in places that actually need these kind of great third spaces. And this person refused to do it. Because to this person, it was more about not having the, you know, basically as if she was going to lose anything by actually coming out and saying, no, there are other places that need this level of attention and design, in particular from the AEC communities. But they wouldn't do it. And I felt like, if we know the impact that those fields can have on creating equity and support within all parts of our worlds, and you don't use your voice to help make that happen, if you're not figuring out like how to make it so that the human capital in those areas are also benefiting in any way, you know, if you're not coming up and going and doing things like how do you support even more equity, you know, in those worlds in a way that make it so that from the sustainability field, from the environmental perspective, even the just the career perspective of AEC, how do you, is there something in it so that we can build those things, from the ground up? And, or do we want to continue with not diversifying those things at all? Because that's the way they kind of look right now. And I think that's also part of the problems that we experience. So, because it shouldn't just be, that this continues to be this very rarefied world in which only a select few get to do the designing, and all of the rest that's associated with it. And I feel like that will actually help create building more equity into the profession and into the actual work that gets done around our world also speaks volumes about who is valued and what's valued and who's doing the design or not. And so I think that's just one of the things that I feel like often doesn't get a lot of attention.
So let's expand on that. This is open to the whole panel, so whoever wants to jump in. How can architects and AEC professionals better integrate principles of environmental justice into their daily practice? What specific tools or frameworks that either of you have kind of come across to help ensure that projects benefit the communities around them, the communities that are most affected by climate change?
There's a tool, Environmental Justice NYC, and it provides a lot of information to the public that can help inform design decisions. And it actually serves as a really good learning tool for architects to help survey a site properly. But it shows where resources are located for project sites. So you can map out proximity of community gardens, which provide open space, food, nutrition. It shows where there are nearby transit routes that could lead to air pollution. And it also provides locations for parks and open spaces that, of course, improve air quality, provide physical activity. It also shows where waste sites are located. So what it does is it merges information from New York City's Department of Health to show areas that are vulnerable to things like diabetes, asthma, where there are mortality. So I'd highly recommend folks check that tool out. Again, it's Environmental Justice NYC. It's a mapper tool.
For us, one of the things that we are doing is we have a pretty well-established engagement process, and that kind of happens at a number of different scales of projects. We have some planners in our in-house that have kind of developed a framework for that. And what we've been working to do, and this is obviously an ongoing thing we're trying to improve, is to make sure we engage those groups that don't necessarily always get engaged, to make sure that their voice is at the table. And that could be on any kind of scale of project. A lot of times you're dealing with steering committees, you're dealing with people at the top who may have been selected by other people at the top, but trying to engage groups that will interact with the building in some way or the space in some way, but probably didn't have their voice traditionally heard. So we try and really encourage that and do that on all of our projects in some ways to have some kind of public engagement with user groups like that.
One of my past lives was I was both at Living Future and then at Eco Districts. And when I first started Eco Districts, especially, we were going into communities and leading these community workshops and having these community stakeholders and talking to people who otherwise weren't being given a voice or an opportunity to even represent. And the founder of Eco Districts, Rob Bennett, who's a lovely man, he gave me some great advice, and he said, and I think about it all the time. He said, you need to bring a certain level of humility to this. And I really took that to heart. Right. And what did he mean by that? Well, he meant we're going to do it this way and you're going to like it. But also you have to kind of bring a certain empathy and care to this work. And I realized that our role in that discussion is to facilitate. We're not going to solve all the problems. We're also not going to solve, in some cases, decades of bad blood between communities and governments and all that. But if you just go in with this idea of let's start asking the questions and let's start finding solutions, you can start to unite everybody around a grander vision around them. And that was what the promise of Eco Districts really, really was, which is now called Just Communities. And I think that's where it's leading up to. But even on our own projects, we're asking, how do we go beyond the walls, beyond the boundaries? How do we go off the campus or whatever it is that we're designing and start to reach out into these communities and give them a seat and give them a voice? And then there's a whole science behind that of, well, you can't just expect everybody to show up on Thursday at 3 p.m. and assume that they're going to be available. You have to have multiple ways that they can participate, because some people are working two or three jobs. And so there's a, again, it comes back to this, like Rob's advice, it comes back to humility.
I just wanted to do a quick reminder for those that have joined us on YouTube. If you have any questions, feedback, feel free to drop those in now. We'll be collecting those, and we're going to, again, try to squeeze in a couple at the end of the discussion. Majora, did you have any thing that you wanted to add to that last question?
Just historically, thanks to systemic bias that exists in the world, and which by association includes AEC. I think it is important. It is wonderful that folks are, I think, some were doing it by hook or by crook all along. But I still think that we need to be even more intentional about the future of any industry, and how has it disproportionately, for the most part, for most industries, not included, underrepresented, marginalized, whatever kind of community, usually poor people of color in these fields. And that's one reason why things get designed the way that they do. And historic, whether racism, classism, they are real. And so I do think it's just like, the ugly thing in the room that nobody really wants to talk about. But it also means that if we're not intentional, as people, this happens on a personal level, an interpersonal level, societal level, then, we're going to keep seeing the same things over and over again. So I just think it's important. So I'm really grateful that folks are thinking humility is important. Recognizing history also equally important. And how do we really keep this as an open opportunity to build more bridges, and also just, with intention, and that's even inclusive of people from those communities actually doing the work.
Yeah. And I think this came up in a couple of your answers, or was referenced, but how do we more effectively communicate with urban planners, policymakers, and communities to ensure that the built environment not only reduces carbon emissions, but also creates spaces that foster social and environmental resilience?
So I think on a community level, I think architects can be involved with civic engagement and work to influence local policies that could address those items. I think participating in city planning meetings, serving on local planning or zoning boards, or even advocating for local zoning laws that would help protect, for example, green spaces, would make a huge impact. I'm on my local zoning board now in New Jersey, in my town, and I'm the only architect on that board. Everyone else comes from a completely different background. And so I think I just want to emphasize maybe there's a lack of architects on and in local groups like these. And so we need to contribute our perspectives where it will be impactful. I think helping shape a local jurisdiction's master plans to integrate issues that there may be ignorance on could help address that.
It's like case in point. That's why it's there was a major architect, in that example that I gave early on, who didn't do that. Because it's just that wasn't, maybe it wasn't who was paying her, just didn't want to put a dog in that fight. But we have to be in those fights if we're really. And I think especially urban planners have this, it's almost a Hippocratic oath that they take, doing no harm. But if you are only doing the same kind of development and working on policies and working with policies without saying anything about it, that we know have traditionally disproportionately added to the environmental and economic assault of those communities by regulations in history, then that's a problem. And, it's something that I see in my work to this day. And it's it's been a long time, since, redlining, existed, even though technically we still have it. And we still plan our communities based on it. We still design our communities based on.
Your partial access code is 5. Your partial access code is 5.
On those kind of histories. And I do think it's really important for those of us, who are in this world, to at least kind of acknowledge it through our work. And it doesn't mean that we're not all going to get work. Of course we will. But ultimately, we know that, who gets the bulk of it and who gets the right to design. That, I think, and really define what happens in our communities, even by broadening the playing field of who even gets to participate. I mean, are those firms hiring more people of color and folks who aren't from the communities that we more traditionally see focused on it? I've been super excited to see, again, I teach at Princeton, and I'm seeing a lot more, you know, architecture students and urban planners, you know, of color and from, frankly, poor white communities who are moving into that profession. And I'm just like, great. Now, let's just make sure we embrace them in really strategic, important ways, because many of them do want to go right back to their own communities and start working in that field. And I think that's really helpful. I think that will help save our planet if we can see more of that.
Your question also asked about social and environmental resilience. And what we've observed in working in these communities is they tend to focus on whatever the last bad thing that happened was. So if they had a flood, then all the resilience planning is focused on either preventing a flood or bouncing back from a flood. If they had a wildfire, it's all focused on that. But in truth, there's a wealth of potential stressors or shocks that could disrupt the normal operations. And since these tend to disrupt the lives of people inequitably, what we've been doing is we've been mapping out, I call it a resiliency dashboard because I don't know what else to call it, but essentially taking that zip code and then mapping out what's the actual climate data tell us? What are the other societal factors that could be disrupted around unemployment rates, graduation rates, traffic patterns, air quality? And then just recently, we kind of converted this into, there's now two pieces. There's this resiliency dashboard that looks at the stresses and shocks, and then this new social determinants of health dashboard that I just finished. It's very rough. But the idea is I put in a zip code, I find which of the community indicators are the most performing badly, let's say, in that community. And then we tie it to environmental factors. So for example, at the top row, it might show that there's a high rate of obesity and heart disease in this community. And then the next row of environmental factors shows that air quality is really poor here. And this is now affecting graduation rates and how many kids attend school. And then we tie that to symptoms, actual medical symptoms. And then all of it culminates in this bit of what can the building that we're about to build do to start to address this? So if we know that obesity is an issue and heart disease is an issue, we look at it through the lens of, is this a food desert? What are the food options? What's the walkability factor? You know, what does that walk score look like? If the air quality is an issue, can we put on a green roof that help can address some of these issues and create an ecosystem and a habitat and a pollinator pathway? So it's kind of stepping out from we need to build a building to kind of, again, blurring those lines and pulling it beyond the boundaries of the building. But then that starts to address this larger issue of resilience and how do we get back to operations after a disruption?
Yeah. Steven?
Yeah, I think along that kind of line that Eric's talking about, I really like to think of things as a network and understand the importance of your piece of the network that you're working on. A lot of times it's so easy to just kind of focus on the building that you're working on and not understand the context that you're working in. In my local community, I'm an advocate for cycling. We don't have a lot of great cycling infrastructure exactly where I live, kind of suburban-ish. And one of the things that keeps coming up is that a cycling network is filled with pieces that are controlled by different people. People aren't going to bike to work if they don't have facilities to lock their bike and wash, but the architect may make that choice. Well, as the civil engineer may make the choice of whether there's a bike path. And there's a whole bunch of factors and there's a whole bunch of groups and people that are responsible for different aspects of that, and understanding that if you pipe your stormwater directly to the city's storm system and it floods 10 kilometers down the road, your building impacted that. That's part of that network, and doing what you can on your project may not stop the flood from happening on your building, but it may actually reduce the flood down the road where the pipe ends, and that's maybe a poorer community or whatever. So understanding that there's a bigger network there, I think, is something that I take into my practice and work.
I know we pulled away from the building for a second there, but let's talk about like one to two of the most critical innovations or materials that are currently available that can make the biggest impact on reducing both operational and embodied carbon in buildings. And then how can architects and other AEC professionals kind of incorporate these into their projects?
I think for me, I mean, there's the easy answer here is air source heat pumps are awesome and fantastic. And there's great things about that. For me, the bigger picture things I'm really excited about in the industry is this idea of small-scale nuclear power and what that could mean for this conversation about clean energy. I know there's some other issues with that, but I think that's really exciting space and innovation that could really change this topic. The second one I'm really excited about is bio-based materials. A lot of stuff happening with different insulations and cladding materials, and that stuff's really exciting to me. And I think that's traditionally how we as humans have dug ourselves out of holes we've created is through innovation. And those are kind of two of the areas that I'm excited about.
Steve and I are both in the, what I would call the expanded Pacific Northwest, right? The kind of that corner of the country. So here, mass timber is a huge driver of a lot of what we do here. We're building buildings out of essentially carbon sequestering wood instead of concrete or instead of steel. And we've adapted the codes both in BC and in Washington and Oregon to adapt to that. But all those biogenic and bio-based materials, to me, are the pathway, right? Of let's grow building materials. Let's grow renewable, abundant, healthy building materials. And let's start to upend that old paradigm of filling the building with toxic, processed, cancer-causing chemicals that just don't make any sense, and really push back on a lot of those old assumptions. I feel like every day I'm arguing with, how do I put this in a way that doesn't offend people? I'm arguing with really confident but wrong people. Confident idiots is what I want to say, but people that are confidently wrong, confidently incorrect in what they're saying, and they're fighting to keep things this terrible is kind of what it feels like. And it's amazing when you come in and you're like, hey, I have a wild idea that can make things better. You're not met with open arms and hugs and cookies. Instead, you're met with just nonstop resistance of people like inventing reasons why it won't work. This kind of, you know, you're just constantly fighting these curmudgeons who are like, man, it won't work. And so I've realized that our job is as sustainability people is to change that culture. So the way that we do it is, you know, here's a typical scenario. Hey, I have an idea. What if we built the building out of mass timber instead of steel or concrete? And this would align with your larger organizational carbon goals. Wouldn't that be a good idea? And they go, yeah, but there's always the but. But I, you know, I heard that wood burns, and I heard this, and I heard that, and I heard it's way more expensive. And so there's a great way to shut down these people, these kind of confident but incorrect people all the time. And I want you all to write this down. And basically you go, oh, how many mass timber buildings have you built, or how many times have you actually done this? Because inevitably they will always answer zero. And then you can say, oh, so you don't really know what you're talking about. And now let's hear from the experts. And then we can actually call in people that do know what they're talking about. And then we can start to have that conversation. And you don't have to do it as an antagonistic way as I do it. You could do it in a more fun way. But I find that people are resisting change for resistance sake. And that's to me the strangest part. And so we're constantly pushing against this friction of momentum. And the momentum's going in the wrong way. You know, if you think about it, we've been building the same way for 200 years. And it's a failed experiment. It doesn't work. We need to shift that paradigm, right?
100%. Well, it's funny because I feel like that's what people do. We are so resistant to change. Innovation, like whatever, sure you are. If you didn't do it, then you don't want to know. And, you know, having, which is all the time. But one of the things that's super, in addition to mass timber, I just got off the phone with an architect who's really been sort of leading it over on the other coast, which I'm very excited about. And hopefully we'll be working with one of my clients over here. But one of the things that I'm also excited about is the how far modular construction has gone on forward. And like, I love it for many different reasons. One, it could be, they can be built off site. There's opportunity for new economic development to happen. It's just like another, you know, super building model that I appreciate. But also going back to the design perspective, you know, and that there are folks who are being open to different types of design. Like, I'm really excited about the more I think about micro units or like more of literally the design type spaces, like having more communal spaces and just housing types that are out there that need to be implemented in some way, or at least explored so that we can deal with the tremendous housing crisis that we're having, you know, in my neck of the woods in New York City. We just built less than 11,000 units of housing of all types in New York City for a whole host of reasons, most of them not helpful for people who are looking to need to be housed. But the point is, it's like whether it's the cost of, you know, subsidy programs or just the cost of construction, blah, blah, blah. But the point is, like, we have to get a lot more open to exploring different housing types, sizes, materials, and ways that actually make it more affordable to build as many as possible.
Farah, did you have anything to add to that one?
Yeah, there's actually, we saw this at Greenbuild, but more and more manufacturers are getting into low carbon materials or zero carbon materials and finding cement alternatives. There's a number out there. It's concrete contributes to 8% of global emissions. And so I'm excited about manufacturers getting into that conversation and providing those alternatives. But you also asked about how operational embodied carbon, like how can we as architects should have reduced that? And I think this is coming up more and more, but the EPD databases that are coming out, we as architects can continue to drive our suppliers and our manufacturers to disclose that product information. And I think we should continue to do that so that we can drive them to go home and come out with products, do their research that help meet the carbon targets that we're looking for in our buildings. And I think that for embodied carbon specifically, that we should become much more enforcers of material specs in that regard. And of course, I think we can be more intentional with our design more compactly, design for function, not aesthetics, so that we could just eliminate unnecessary materials, think about permanence of design for flexibility of spaces.
All right, we're coming to the end, and I know you got a heart out, Farah. So I want to try to squeeze in one final question, if you can all kind of keep it down to 30 seconds or less. So for the panel, what's the most actionable advice you would give to architects and AEC professionals who want to contribute to meaningful environmental justice and or climate change mitigation in their projects?
Just start. Just go. You don't need to be an expert. You really just need to be asking questions. And don't be afraid of looking foolish. I ask stupid questions all day long. And I don't even know if people look at me funny. But asking the question of why are we doing this or why are we doing it that way? What I find is that a lot of people are preemptively shutting down the discourse simply because they don't want to look foolish or they don't want to ask the question or they thought maybe everybody knows and I don't. So we need to get over that. And that would be it. That would be my big advice. Just start asking questions.
I would say from a bigger picture point of view, don't start a project without asking the sustainability question. Because it's shocking how many projects get into design development and you look around and it's like, did anyone ask the client if they had any standards to meet? Like, I guess not. I was like, too late now. So I just make sure that's part of the conversation at day one, not at day 100. That'll make a huge difference.
I'd say listen very carefully for words that are not necessarily, you know, sustainability based, but people talk about communities and are often really influenced by wanting their communities to be more sustainable. It just might sound a little different, you know, so think being open to that. And then also just like use whatever you have, which is your career, you know, to inform some folks that it is a career and just to like let them know that this is a possibility for folks. And obviously they go to school or whatever, but I think it's important that folks that in order to democratize the idea of sustainability, that people also, it would be great if they understood that there are people from communities that are not like theirs could be involved in it as well.
Yep, and I would say just continue to measure performance. Don't forget about the building's afterlife. Leverage the technology and the tools that we do have to make informed decisions. Prior to design, you know, you've got BIM, you've got LCA tools, data analytics. After design, you can continue monitoring. So do use that data and use it to drive change.
Thank you so much, everyone. Quick shout out on YouTube we got for Majora's book. Someone said Majora's book is excellent. She came to Mansfield as part of a speaking series put on by our local news source. Gave us a lot to think about as well as actionable information. So just wanted to share that really quick. And then
go Mansfield. I had a great time there. Thank you. Hello. Not sure who you are, but I love you all.
We've been speaking to Stephen Bierstaker, Architect AIBC, an associate at ThinkSpace Architecture Planning and Interiors. Farah Kadir, registered architect, lead AP LFA, senior sustainable design project manager at NYC School Construction Authority. Eric Corey Freed, registered architect, lead fellow, Eco Districts AP LFA, Active Score AP, and principal and director of sustainability at Canon Design. And Majora Carter, resident real estate developer, urban revitalization strategy consultant, MacArthur Fellow, and Peabody Award-winning broadcaster. To the audience, please thank the panel in the chat and by following along with them, subscribing to their content, and grabbing their books. And one last reminder, if you are not currently a Gable Media member, you still have a chance to receive one AIA HSW credit for watching this session by becoming a member today. So just go to gablemedia.com/members. Again, becoming a member today will get you credit for this session. Hold your spot for all future All Access Series events. Access to our innovative podcast-based continuing education program, which we have 30 courses available right now, and even more on the way. And you'll have the inside scoop on other Gable Media events and perks. Okay, squeeze in that one last question. Warmer oceans equal, let's see. Warmer oceans equal more moisture in the air, although apparently not in the Northeast at the moment. I've been trying to call it climate disruption instead. That was more of a comment, not a question. Let's see. These are all comments that I'm seeing. I'm becoming a fan of community benefit ordinances. Have any panelists been part of developing a CBO or any other anti-displacement language for development?
Yeah, we did this. It's when you do what we call an eco-district. In other words, when you galvanize an entire neighborhood or district community together, typically there's a structural organization that you use to do that. And so there were eco-districts that were built around the CBO concepts. But there's a lot of different kind of governing structures that you can use to do that. If you go to justcommunities.org, I think you can probably download their guidebook and you can see what's available. But it's a great structure. You know, a lot of planners assume that they have a very limited set of tools, and they don't. They're forgetting that people want to make the place that they live better. It's in their best interest. So if you offer it to them, I mean, like what Majora has done, if you offer it to them, then they're more than happy to participate, I think, if you give them the opportunity.
Yeah. And I'm not even sure. I mean, look, I'm grateful that there are opportunities out there, whether they're CBOs, true CBAs, but I've also seen them just hyper distorted, unless, of course, they come directly from the community and community in some way plays the role of developer in it. So it's just like that is the client that's being answered to, not some city, not some outside developer who's determining, like, who's deciding to be nice, you know, to a community group. That almost never plays well. But there's some great opportunities that I think some stories that have been out there. Actually, the Times did a really good one, but one of my favorite stories about this where it was done without a CBO or a CBA, but it's called EBPREC, East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative. They were co-investors, you know, co-builders, co-designers, and it really was about how do you create these things, you know, on the ground with a level of intention to prove that people didn't have to move out of their neighborhoods to live in a better one by building a very intentional way for project that would enhance their own communities.
Thank you all again for attending Building a Resilient Future, Architecture, Climate Action, and Environmental Justice, Gable Media's All Access Series event. We'll jump into the chat. This is a huge and very important topic, actually many topics, but many people ignore it because it is so big and complicated, non-professionals don't understand it. How can this be simplified so more people understand how to make a difference? Can sustainability and resilience be rebranded to be more mainstream?
I deal with this quite a bit in my social media, trying to post this stuff on social media and get traction on it, because you really have to simplify things down to like really key trigger points. One of the interesting things I found online, I forget who actually created it, but it's called Talk Like a Human. And it talks about how when you come up to someone and you say, you know, you should have lower carbon emissions, people don't engage with that and want to change. But when you say like you want to have cleaner air, you want to have healthier communities, that really motivates people to change. So I think that question about sustainability and resilience being rebranded to be more mainstream is a lot about how we talk about things. When we say like climate change, it's like it's this massive thing that's way bigger than any of us. And it's really tough to get people to know how to make a difference and change. Or when you say like eat less meat, it's also really kind of, I don't know, it's challenging. I think we just need to be talking about it in a more human way, yeah. I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. I do think that, you know, unfortunately, folks who are in both the environmentalism and sustainability world, and, you know, I think many of us come from a tradition where it was sort of like a rarefied thing. And, you know, you had to be super smart, educated to get into it. And so I think it suffers from like always wanting to be the smartest kid in the room kind of thing. I think that's a lot of different fields. But I find, honestly, environmentalists, especially the conservationists, are really annoying. Because it's just like...
Your partial access code is G. Your partial access code is G.
Relax, people. But anywho, but I really do feel like that if we talking like a human is helpful, you know, because everyone on some level has been doing this almost because they had to. People have been conserving energy because maybe it costs a lot. And it's just like, no, you close your windows. No, you wear a sweater. No, you're reusing and recycling things because you kind of had to. And so many of our cultures did that, and we don't give that any kind of real support or just like, no, that is a beautiful thing to do. You've been doing it all along. Thank you very much. You've been saving the environment long before, you know, people started getting like excited about polar bears dying. It's like, no, you were saving humanity. Thank you very much. And I just honestly just need to think we have to just remember to be human. You're right. Thank you so much for saying that, Stephen, because we're just, that's the problem with people. That's who we are, unless we decide to be great people.
Yeah, you know, my company is 1,300 people. And, you know, if you're director of sustainability at any large firm, architecture or not, you get a lot of, why aren't we serving fair trade coffee in the office? You know, why aren't we composting all the food waste in all the offices? And sad reality is that is such a minuscule part of our overall footprint. Should we do it? Yes, and we'll do it as we can. But honestly, improving the concrete mix in one of our buildings would have such a much more profound effect on climate change, and getting community and stakeholder buy-in on a project would have such a much bigger impact than, God forbid, we didn't use recycled napkins. But it's also a matter of scale. It feels like for the last 50 years, we've trained everybody to feel guilty about their decisions, and it's pushed people away. And the truth is, it's probably not because Sally had a hamburger is to blame. It's probably the fact that the fossil fuel industry, the plastics industry, the agricultural industry have all designed a system to make you feel bad about your choices while they rake in billions in profits. And, you know, I have a lot of hardcore environmentalist friends, and I love them dearly, but they're really annoying. And they carry, you know, they carry their own silverware and they carry their own reusable straw in the other pocket. And, you know, they scold you.
I do that
and,
too, but.
But, and it's great, right? But the level of change that we need is not to make everybody feel bad about what they're doing, but rather get them excited. And
yeah,
to me, I think we're offering a better solution, right? I'm offering you a better building. I'm offering you a building that has fresh air, that avoids all known cancer-causing chemicals, that potentially could boost student performance scores or boost patient recovery times. Like, that is a way better value proposition than let's build it the cheapest and fastest way possible.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and it kind of all comes back to this. It's, if environmentalism doesn't talk about human psychology, right, it's not going to go anywhere. And no matter what you think about the person, Elon Musk is a great example of someone who's made electric cars cool. It's just, doesn't matter what you think about what it does for the environment. He didn't even talk about that. He just sold the coolest car ever. And now it's changing the industry. So I think to your point about giving people better buildings, that's really what you're doing and pitching.
There's a quote from T.S. Eliot that's kind of haunted me my whole life, which is, the worst treason is to do the right thing for the wrong reason. And if we get everybody driving electric cars because they think they're cool, great. I don't care. I don't care if it's the wrong reason. Right? You know, fine. But also, the trouble with environmentalists is it's never enough. So moving everybody from fossil fuel cars to electric cars is good. It's a good thing. And it's certainly a step in the right direction. But then why the hell are all these people in cars in the first place? Why do we design all of our cities around car-centric instead of people-centric first? Like, there's always another problem to solve, which really muddies the water for a lot of people. And I feel like that's why a lot of people end up checking out of the environmental conversation.
Yeah. I'd like to see if we could, if anyone's brave enough to jump in and call in, you're welcome to do so. In the meantime, I'm going to go over this one last question unless we get a call. What about the term scale? Can we get to worldwide transition if we focus only on the top 20% of big architecture firms to transition them? What about the 80%?
So my firm is one of those big firms, right? We're part of a group called the Large Firm Roundtable, which is administered by the AIA. It's the 60 or so largest firms in the world. And it's all the names that you would expect to see on that list. It's, you know, Gensler and Perkins and Will and great firms with great people. All told, it's like 125,000 design professionals. How do you measure the 20%? Is the 20% sheerly by number? Is the 20% by number of staff? Is it by number of projects or square footage? But the nice part about the LFRT, that Large Firm Roundtable, is that I sit on the sustainability committee. It's my kind of equivalent sustainability directors from all those firms. We all get together. We're all friends. It's basically a giant group therapy session, really, because we're all struggling with the same things. My CEO is part of the CEO group. He gets to meet with all the other CEOs and talk about things. It's been incredibly helpful, especially through COVID, for us to talk about how do we scale our efforts? How do we work together instead of as competitors? How do we really get to the level of impact that we need to get to in the short time that we have? We don't have any great answers yet, but we're putting together a number of kind of tools and resources to help these firms do that, so we don't all need to reinvent the wheel. So that helps. But I don't think it's just architects alone. I mean, the architects are not involved in every building, unfortunately. There's a lot of building going on that does not include us or include the community.
Yeah, I think for me, the big firms kind of offer leadership to the rest of us in that way. Like, we look to the bigger groups to be setting the stage. And I think that's where kind of this idea of a rising tide raises all ships, right? Like, if the top firms are doing really, really great sustainable architecture, like, it does bring up all of the other firms to be like, hey, look at them. Let's, you know, do that too. So I think it does make a difference that way. And I'm glad to hear, Eric, that there's, you know, roundtables and stuff that's going on to help raise that as well, which is really cool.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's plenty of people that are out there practicing. And if they're the 20% big ones, then there's 80% of the other one. That means that there's a lot of work out there. And is there a way to ensure that they're, again, it goes back to who gets to really be the folks who are out there building the design, and it is getting all the contracts, and it is determining, are places being generated in ways that are inclusive of the people that are in them? And I really do think that that's where, like, the other 80% is coming in. And is it really creating the kind of capacity within those, within the world of AEC, that's allowing folks to be bigger participants in some way, shape, or form? I don't think I have an answer to how, but it does make me feel much better that folks are even starting to have those kind of conversations. I've only worked with one of the big ones, Perkins Eastman. So the way that they've worked with me over all of these years, like, I'm a small potato as a developer, but they looked at me as for what the future that I was going to be creating in terms of the type of projects and the innovation I was bringing to the field, and were very supportive, you know, of helping me to get to the point where, you know, we will be doing some, that I will be able to hire them in the future, as opposed to just like expecting, you know, hoping that they'll like see the future that I'm trying to create and that maybe they can sort of come along with me. And I feel like the way that they literally approached and supported the work that I've been trying to do over these years without having, you know, the kind of support of, you know, a major firm behind me, they sort of gave me the imprimatur of being that, of being a much, much bigger than I actually was. But it was that I never would have been able to do that without that kind of support. And so I feel like that could happen more if people wanted it to.
Yeah. Who was that company again? You had Perkins dropped Eastman. During the second.
Oh, sorry. Perkins Eastman.
No one was brave enough to call in this time. So we'll try to make it happen the next time. But thank you, everybody, for joining us. Once again, please thank the panel through the chat and by following along with them, subscribing to their content, grabbing their books. We really appreciate you being a member and supporting what we're doing here at Gable Media. We value your opinion. So if you have any feedback that you would like to share, feel free to do so at admin@gablemedia.com. We'd love to hear from you. And if you enjoyed today's event and found it valuable, please do us a favor and tell a friend. We'd love to welcome them as a Gable Media, Keep It Gable Media member as well. Thank you and have a great rest of your day. Thank you all, panel.
Thank you. Take care, everybody.